Welcome to the CGA IGC podcast series, brought to you by CGA's Education Committee and made possible through the generous support of our sponsor, Linsight. Each episode aims to bring you an in-depth discussion related to emerging data, clinical challenges, and unique perspectives in the world of hereditary GI cancers. Before we start, we'd like to remind you that the content of this podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and the content reflects expert opinion at the time of recording. Keep listening to find out more about this episode's host, guest, and featured topic. Also, be sure to learn more about our sponsor at linsightlabs.com. That's L-Y-N-S-I-G-H-T labs.com.
Hello and welcome to the CGA IGC podcast. This is part two of the Research Collaboration podcast series. Please check out our first podcast hosted by Joshua Melson on the Lineage Consortium. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Ophir Gilad, who is leading the Gastric PDH1 Multicenter Consortium. So I want to welcome Ophir. Ophir, why don't you start us off with just a brief introduction and tell us about your role at UChicago and your role in this project.
Thank you, Emma. Glad to be here. I am a gastroenterologist by training. I'm currently a research fellow working at the University of Chicago GI Risk and Prevention Clinic together with you and Christine Drogan and led by Dr. Sonia Kupfer. I am one of the people who established it. I'm the one who started the idea, but I had a lot of support from our colleagues here at the University of Chicago and a lot of collaborators from CGA IGC that also deal with a lot of CDH1 patients.
Tell us, where did the idea for this consortium come from? And were there specific research questions that you had or wanted to look into?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. So when I started here at the Risk and Prevention Clinic, I actually had just started dealing with hereditary GI cancer syndromes. I had some experience with Lynch syndrome and FAP, but I've never seen a CDH1 patient. And actually, when I came to Chicago, all of a sudden, we started seeing a lot of CDH1 patients, and that kind of scared me because I didn't know how to deal with CDH1 patient and how to counsel them. And I started reading about it and I saw that there's a lot of open questions. How many of these patients really need to undergo prophylactic gastrectomy? Just the background, CDH1 patients were thought to have a lifetime risk of developing gastric cancer, which was estimated to be as high as 80%. But those numbers were based on studies that looked at highly penetrant families from New Zealand. And as time went on and more research came in, we started seeing that a lot of people are actually not affected by stomach cancers, and the risk estimations dropped down to 40%, maybe 20-something percent in Megan Roberts' studies. And recently, a study last year from the NIH noted that the risk can be as low as 7 to 10%. So this was a moving field, an advancing field, and there were a lot of questions that we didn't know how to answer. And one of the main things that we are interested in is which patients, which CDH1 carriers are going to develop full-blown cancers, and what patients are going to just have their stomachs remain intact. One other thing to note is that virtually all CDH1 patients have signet ring cell carcinoma cells identified on their gastrectomy specimen. So this is not something, this is something we look at, but it doesn't necessarily mean that this specific patient is going to develop cancer. So I was interested to find out which patients will eventually develop full-blown invasive or aggressive cancers, and which one will just have an indolent signet ring cell or signet ring cell foci in their stomachs throughout their lifetime. So when I don't know something, I try to look at, to study everything about it. So I started collecting data that we had here at the University of Chicago. And we had, at that time, we had about 40 or 50 patients that were seeing throughout the years here at our registry. And I started collecting endoscopic and histologic data about them. Coincidentally, at the same time, our pathologists reviewed gastrectomy specimens of about 20 CDH1 patients and tried to correlate specific stainings They looked at the TP53 and Ki-67 and looked at abnormal morphology or poorly differentiated morphology and tried to see if they can find a correlation between these findings and the more aggressive phenotype. So we actually combined my data with their data and started presenting it in conferences. And Dr. Kupfer had actually previously collaborated with several other centers in a study that looked at whether or not CDH1 carriers have a higher risk of developing colorectal cancer. And that study was actually, they did not show any increased risk. And she brought up the idea of, hey, this is, I mean, CDH1 is a rare cancer, it's a rare syndrome, and we still have low numbers. And we thought, hey, what about if we reach out to those in those centers that participated in our previous collaboration and see whether or not they want to get a broader look and look at all these endoscopic, histological, and clinical data that I looked at. So we had a few Zoom meetings, discussed this, and most of these centers were excited to collaborate. And that's how the Gastric Consortium started.
Got it. Yeah, this is certainly a challenge in the field right now, the shifting paradigm of how to manage CDH1 patients. I know that we have a lot of people at our institution with no family histories, and it's difficult to tell them what they can expect for the future. So you mentioned that you're looking at endoscopic and histological data on the gastrectomy specimens and biopsies. Are there other questions or secondary goals that have come up as you've been collecting data and building this consortium and learning more? Are there things that you've discovered you have questions about?
Yes, excellent question. So when we started collaborating, that was my main goal. But as other centers joined us, different researchers had other questions they wanted to look at. So we have two other goals that we're actually actively looking at right now. We're trying to see, we're doing a penetrance analysis on a multi-center scale, looking at all of our, we're collecting pedigree data and trying to see what the penetrance is. And we're trying to look at not just first and second, whether the risk increases or decreases when there are multiple family members and not just first degree relatives. And we're hopefully we'll have results very soon. And we're also looking at post-surgery complication rates and what the complications are, because this is a very unique population, because these are individuals, the people who are undergoing surgery, who are undergoing a very significant and a very large surgery with increased morbidity and mortality. And these are basically healthy individuals that don't actually have active cancer. They are not active cancer patients on the one hand, and they're actually more closely related and have more complications that are similar to what bariatric patients are undergoing when they undergo gastric bypass surgery, with the one caveat that these individuals in most cases are not overweight or do not have obesity and other comorbidities. So it affects them differently from the bariatric population. And also the surgeries are not the same, the bariatric surgeries and their baseline syndrome. So these are two other secondary aims that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, we have this entire generation of people that had their stomachs out. And so I guess we're now getting to that point where we have this longer term data where we can look at it. And it's, you're right, it probably looks a lot different than somebody who's getting their stomach removed for treatment purposes. I'm curious about the early planning of this. So you mentioned there was a few initial Zoom calls and there had to be kind of some excitement from all of these other centers. Was there a goal for how many patients you wanted to recruit or how many centers you wanted? Were there diversity goals that you were trying to meet?
So we didn't per se set up a goal. We wanted as many collaborators as we can get because this is a rare syndrome. And even centers who had just a handful of patients, we said we welcome everyone who wants to collaborate. It was important for us to be transparent. Everyone will be able to see everyone else's data, which is obviously de-identified without any identifiers. And we just try to collect as many patients as possible, trying to create the largest cohort to date. We currently are in the process of writing down our results to date because we feel like we've reached a certain amount of patients that is significant. And we also have a lot of post-surgical data and gastrectomy data, including patients with more advanced disease and not just a regular let's call it garden variety signet ring cells that remain dormant. So we have a lot of those. So it would be interesting to see whether or not we are able to identify predictors of invasiveness. We might need to collect some more data and have a more longitudinal datum to get to have more precise conclusions, but it's an interesting phase right now.
How did you guys start collecting this data? And I know that we're doing this at a REDCap database, but how were you able to figure this out amongst institutions?
So we started standardizing the protocol, understanding what every institution is going to collect, how are we going to capture the data, and what are the fields that we're looking at, and whether or not everyone would be able to enter those fields if they are available to them or not. We then built a REDCap database, which underwent several iterations. We had several Zoom meetings and Zoom calls where we went over the REDCap. Pretty much every meeting had its own comments and its own additions or subtractions. So it was a process that required several meetings and just going over what the data until we finalized the data and saw that this is what we want to capture. And I'm pretty sure that at a certain point, we can always get more and more data. There are other things that we can collect and look at. The possibilities are endless, but we also want it to be feasible. We want people who enter data to be able to get the data in a timely manner. So that was important for us to not overwhelm the people who are collecting the data, because this study is not funded. The people who are entering the data are entering this on their own time. And I'm thankful for everyone who put the time in, and I appreciate that. And having an hour-long data entry for a patient, this is just not something that collaborators would have been able to cope with.
Yeah, I do remember being part of this too. And to do the penetrance analysis, it requires numbering every single family member in the pedigree and then entering every single one of those individuals into the database. So definitely grueling data entry. Tell me a little bit about the IRB process. How did you set up data use agreements? Where is the oversight coming from?
Okay, so there are two parts of this. So the IRB, at the beginning, we were wondering whether or not to have a central IRB with Reliance. So there is just one address for the IRB, there's not multiple IRBs, but that actually, when we looked into this, seemed to be more complicated and required sites to agree on the same terms. And different sites sometimes have different preferences, and it might deter them if they can't have their own IRB. So we decided that every site should have their own IRB approval. That actually did not take a lot of time. The data use agreement was actually the part that took the longest. So when we do data use agreements, this is a legal document that states every site's responsibilities, what happens if there's a data breach, who owns the data. And we started with 8 centers. And when there's 8 centers, it means that every time someone wants to change something in the draft, they have to get the approval of the other 7 centers. So it takes a lot of back and forth, and it takes a lot of time, which is, if I can give advice to someone else who starts a data use agreement process, I would recommend starting it as soon as possible, because it takes weeks, if not months, for it to be completed. And try to get as many centers on the first go as you can, because once the data use agreement is finalized, that means all the back and forth is done, and all of the centers who are in this first batch have agreed upon a certain phrasing and wording of the document, then it would be extremely difficult to change this again. Because if other centers want to join, they will have to accept the data use agreement document as it is, because the other centers would usually not be up to opening it up again and making changes to it. So start it as soon as possible, but get as many people on the first go as you can. That's my recommendations for you.
I didn't know that you could do it as kind of a group like that. So did you have to end up addending the initial data use agreement to invite other institutions into this?
So other institutions joined us as time went by and people heard about this consortium. It was in the beginning, for most cases, it was pretty easy. It still takes a few weeks for each institution to sign the amendment or the joinder to the data use agreement. There was one hiccup, and that's another thing I didn't think of initially when we started this. The first 8 centers are all from the United States. We currently had the last center join us from Canada. And there are differences when you're dealing with international sites. Even though, I mean, these are our neighbors from across the border, they have different laws. And there was just a different phrasing about the fact that the data use agreement, that it only pertains to American law, that made it very difficult for the Canadians to sign the data use agreement. But we found a way to work around that, and we just created a different amendment for them that was signed. But that was a little bit of a hiccup that we didn't think about beforehand. And this is something that should be thought of if other international sites are going to join.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work. As people were putting in data, were there data quality audits that had to be done? How did you make sure that people were putting in all the right stuff? I know that a lot of this was agreed on at the beginning, but I know from experience that sticking this data, and I kept having to go back to the protocol to remember exactly what was correct and what wasn't.
So first of all, you said we created an instruction manual so people can go back and read. And we included I wanted it to be succinct so people actually go through it and read it. Because if it's going to be 30 pages long, people are not going to read everything. So I put in the things that I thought are going to be the most problematic and most people are going to have the more difficulty understanding what to put in. The other thing you need to think about is that when you're the one who's building the database, you know what you meant, but other people might not have the same knowledge base that you have, not have the same training that you have, and they come from different backgrounds. So you need to adjust this for anyone to be able to understand and put in the data as you meant it. So it is important to keep it as simple as possible. And the good thing in REDCap is that it allows you to put in notes or side notes so you can explain exactly what you meant for the people who are entering the data. Obviously, being available for question is very important. So people were, if people had any question, they were able to email me and I tried to answer as quickly as I could. If there were significant questions that required attention and questions that might have that other sites might have encountered as well, I would send an email blast with that specific topic and discussing what I think the correct approach should be. It was also important for me to go over REDCap data entry with each site individually so I can have the utmost attention to that site, and that sometimes people, when they're in a group, they feel uncomfortable asking questions or embarrassed that they might be asking something that is clear to others. So it was important for me to do a one-on-one with the different centers and just have an hour for each and every one of them and more if they required more. So that was another thing. And data audits. Whenever a site joined the consortium, after a few weeks, I would download their data entries and go over and see if this is what I expect. And I would give them feedback whether or not this is something I would do different, and I would ask them questions if there is something that I didn't understand correctly.
Wow. So we saw this too, but you really put in a lot of time and work and energy into this. And I guess that's what this kind of project requires. So it's really amazing. I'm wondering also, as we kind of get to the end here, you mentioned some unforeseen issues with the data use agreement and including an international site. Are there other lessons learned, other unforeseen issues that came up? How are these fixed? And are there things that you would do differently in a project like this?
That was my issue. My issue was the Canadian issue. We didn't actually have, I mean, there were minor things, not something big.
Got it. How did you recruit for this project? I know there's a lot of clinicians and institutions out there that see a lot of CDH1 patients and clearly understand why it's important to get answers for this. But again, it's a lot of work to be part of a project like this. So how did you convince people? Where did you do it?
Great question. So as I said, our first approach was to reach out to people who previously worked with us on this colorectal cancer CDH1 project. But we also presented our data in national and international conferences. The first conference was in DDW. I think it was in 2023, I believe. And when we presented our data, we mentioned that we are planning to take this single center study into a multi-center process capacity. At the end of our slides, we put in our contact information. We had a QR code, and we asked people that if they have CDH1 patients and they want to share their data with us, that they are welcome to reach out. Funny story, my presentation at the first DDW was the last, pretty much one next to last presentation of the conference. So there wasn't a lot of attendance because people usually at that time need to get to their flights. But we also submitted this to that year's CGA-IGC annual meeting, which had a lot more attendance. And after CGA-IGC, we got a lot more interest from other centers, and that's how we got other centers to join us. We also presented our initial outcomes from gastric and the International Society of Hereditary GI Tumors Insight. Then we had some more centers that were interested after that. So reaching out to previous collaborators and then presenting our data and inviting others to join us in national and international conferences were the way that we chose to go.
Got it. So, I mean, it also sounds like many of the collaborators here are CGA affiliated in some way.
Pretty much every single site has a CGA-IGC representative.
Wow. So that conference is really the turning point for this recruitment. That's cool.
Definitely.
Looking forward, you mentioned that you're doing some data analysis and we're looking over results now. Is this database going to be living and breathing? Are you going to invite more collaborators as some publications come out?
That's actually something we're discussing with us. We're looking right now at the possibility of taking this database. Currently, it is retrospective, so we're looking at whether or not we would be able to take it into a prospective capacity that requires a little bit more funding and it requires more time. There's a lot of interest from other collaborators to take this into a prospective database, and that's what I hope will come out of it. We're still not there, but we're getting there.
That would be really exciting to continue to collect this data. It also might be interesting to talk to some patients and families and see if there's any questions they have that we could potentially collect data on.
Definitely. I mean, we have reached out to an advocacy group called No Stomach for Cancer, and we presented our data with them, and they were very interested. We didn't talk about whether or not they have any specific questions for us to look at, but the questions that we're asking right now is what they're interested in themselves. But yeah, we all had an advocacy group that we shared our data with.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Ophir. Like I said, this has been a lot of work on your part, and it's been really impressive to see you take this project on and do such a good job with this and be so persistent.
I just want to add that it's been challenging, but it's also been very rewarding. This undergoing has been very rewarding for me.
Thank you, Ophir. And with that, we'll end our second podcast as part of the research collaboration series. Please take a look at our first podcast on the Lineage Consortium and stay tuned for the CMMRD Consortium podcast coming up next.